Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, email, Google+, simple ways that you can share Issues Etc. programs with your friends, relatives, and fellow parishioners. Just go to Listen on Demand Archives at issuesetc.org and look for the share feature images posted beneath each audio segment. You're only one click away from telling someone about Issues Etc. The Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org and look for Share This.
The National Day of Prayer is approaching. I have the privilege of serving as the honorary chairman this year.
There's a comment by a Roman Catholic bishop. I will die in my bed. My successor will die in jail. His successor will be martyred, and his successor will begin to rebuild from the ashes.
A spirit-filled congregation is not measured by the number of goosebumps that are raised in a worship service, but rather a spirit-filled congregation is found in how much Christ is declared to you.
Lutherans who are married to Catholics love Issues Etc.
The church is one foundation. It is Christ our Lord.
It's a little book. It is very different than what most people expect. Most people expect that the Holy Book of Islam, the Quran, would be kind of a parallel to the Holy Book of Christianity, the Old and New Testament, a rather lengthy thing, a narrative largely, a little poetry thrown in there, here and there, maybe even more akin to the New Testament. Well, what is the Quran, and do Christians have any business studying it, knowing it? Is it actually necessary that Christians in this age of the rise of Islam as a truly global, in this global world, a truly global religion, to know what the Quran says, what it doesn't say, and therefore what Muslims believe and teach as well. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. on this Monday afternoon. It's April the 29th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. James White's going to join us for the first hour of the program. We're going to be talking about the teachings of the Quran, and we do invite your questions and your comments. In the second hour of the program, President Barack Obama gave a speech Friday at Planned Parenthood's National Conference. It's a short speech. He hit all the right notes with the crowd he was speaking to. They loved him. He loved them. We're going to respond to almost all of President Obama's speech to Planned Parenthood in the second hour of Issues Etc. with Scott Klusendorf, president of Life Training Institute. Now, our call-in number for the next 2 hours, 1-877-623-MY-IE, 877-623-6943. During the first hour, we're giving away James White's new book, What Every Christian Needs to Know About the Quran, 1-877-623-MY-IE, 877-623-6943. Send us an email right here in the studio, talkback at issuesetc.org, a tweet at issuesetc, or you can leave questions or comments for James in this first hour, facebook.com/issuesetc. That's our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. James White is a regular guest. He's director of Alpha and Omega Ministries based in Phoenix, Arizona, and he's author of several books, including his latest, What Every Christian Needs to Know About the Quran. James, welcome back.
It's great to be with you.
Why should Christians bother to study, to look at, to understand the Quran?
Well, if they want to turn the news on at any time and understand what's going on, it might help. I mean, there's just so often these days we turn on the television, get our RSS feeds from the internet, whatever it might be, and lo and behold, we have a discussion of Islam. And while obviously there are a wide variety of understandings of the Quran and things like that, and you have the Shiites and the Sunnis, and there's all sorts of subdivisions amongst the Sunnis and all the rest of that stuff, you've still got one primary text. And it's like asking the question, well, you know, if you want to have some understanding of Christianity, should you bother to read the Bible? Well, don't we wish more people did? There are so many people that claim to have some understanding of our faith, and yet they clearly have never even touched the text that supposedly gives the very form to our faith and our doctrine, our teaching and practice, and so on and so forth. So when I've been speaking for a number of years now on Islam, I'll ask Christian audiences, I'll say, how many of you read the Quran? And I'll have just a couple of people, sometimes none, but sometimes, and they'll sort of put their hand halfway up, and I'll go, parts, right? And they go, yeah, parts. And I have a feeling, sadly, that if I were to ask the same question in an Islamic context, that I would very much get the same kind of response. And so when you have two major world religions, and the one, Islam, actually comes after Christianity, at least from our perspective historically, and hence its book addresses us directly, and yet the vast majority of the people on both sides don't know almost anything firsthand about what the other side believes, at least in Western countries that's the case, then we're going to be talking past each other, and it's going to be very difficult to have meaningful conversations. And so I learned a long time ago when I first started studying Mormonism, if I was going to talk to Mormons on a regular basis, I needed to read the Book of Mormon, Doctrine Covenants for a Great Price. If you're going to be talking to Muslims, I mean, the Quran is only about 57% the length of the New Testament. It's not like reading Tolstoy or something. It's a very, very good idea to have shown them the respect to be familiar with that text and to be familiar especially with what it says to us, because that then can become the gateway through which I can transition the conversation into what the Bible says in response to what the Quran said. And so that's just one of, I think, a number of reasons to be familiar with the book.
Most people assume, because they simply are almost entirely unfamiliar with the Quran, that it's kind of a parallel to the Christian scriptures, Old and New Testament, rather lengthy book covering many thousands of years of narrative and of history. Give us, and it isn't, it's not even a parallel to the New Testament. What in the world is the thing?
Well, from the answer to that is twofold. From the Islamic perspective, the Quran is an eternal revelation of Allah. It is co-equal with Allah as far as its eternity is concerned. It is uncreated. This is the Sunni perspective. This is the Orthodox Sunni perspective. It developed over time, but that's where the majority of the Muslims you're going to be talking to are going to be Sunni. About 88% of the world's population is Sunni, about 10% Shiite, and there's others mixed in there, obviously. But for the Orthodox Sunni, it's uncreated. It's the very words of Allah. It's dictated to the angel Jibril. It's given to Muhammad, dictated to him. And this is where it really starts differing from our understanding of Scripture from our perspective. There is nothing of Muhammad in the Quran. Nothing. You can't ask, what did Muhammad understand of the Trinity? You can't ask, does this come from that period of time in Arabia? All of that is utterly irrelevant to Orthodox Sunni interpretation of the Quran. The Quran is a divine revelation. Muhammad has nothing to do with it. What he understood or anything else is irrelevant to the text of the Quran. So while we are, I was preaching in Hebrews yesterday at my church, and so last evening they got a tough sermon where I had to deal with some difficult issues in Hebrews chapter 11 and the relationship of faith and justification in regards to Abraham and then the offering of Isaac, and so I'm looking at James, and I'm looking at the Old Testament, I'm doing all this stuff and looking at the backgrounds and context and language, all that stuff. There's just no reason to do that for the vast majority of Muslims, because that's not what you're looking at. What someone understood, where they were in a context in history, all that just doesn't matter. What's worse is if anyone tries to pick up the Quran and just try to start at the beginning and read through it, you will be so completely lost because of the organization of the Quran. Now, by the way, let me mention, Muslims would not believe you're reading the Quran. The Quran only exists in Arabic. It does not exist in any other language. There are numerous translations. They won't even use the term translation. Most of the time, they will normally utilize terms like transliteration, things like that. But the Quran, from the real diehard Orthodox perspective, only exists in Arabic, and therefore, even I haven't read the Quran because I've only read portions of the Quran in Arabic. And in fact, the vast majority of Muslims in the world have not read the Quran, because only about 16 to 19% of the world's Muslims are themselves Arabic and hence can actually read that language natively. So there's something to keep in mind when we're talking about reading the Quran. But if you try to read it, whatever you do, don't start at the beginning and go through to the end. You'll be completely lost. I included a chart in the book that gives you the best guess, one of the best guesses that we can give you as to the chronological order in which the chapters of the Quran were written. They're not put in the book that way. The first chapter, Surah Al-Fatiha, is a opening prayer, and then you have Surah Al-Baqarah, which is the cow, that's the longest, Surah 2, then Surah 3 is a little bit shorter, Surah 4 is a little bit shorter, so it's in order of size. And the problem is, if you try to read it that way, you're going to be bouncing back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, between two major periods in Muhammad's life. Now, for most people who are just picking up the Quran to try to read it, since they don't think about Muhammad's life, that's not a major deal because they're still not going to be able to figure out what's going on. But if you're trying to follow it and you know something about Muhammad's life, which is why I had to include a chapter on that subject, then you know the two major periods of his life, as far as his prophethood goes, are between 610, his calling as a prophet, and 622, when he's a minority prophet in Mecca, preaching against polytheism, preaching for monotheism. And then you have the Hijra in 622, where he migrates to what's now called Medina, at the time was called Yathrib, and becomes the city of the prophet. And now he's at the head of an army, and things are very, very different. And when you see, actually the number of surahs is uneven between those two periods, but the bulk of the material is about evenly divided between the Meccan and Medinan period. And once you read them in that way and read them in that order, you can clearly see an evolutionary process and a change in topic and things like that. And yet most people who just pick it up and try starting from the beginning would never see that because they're bouncing back and forth between these things. So the Quran is very difficult along those lines. And there are many people who would say there's entire portions of the Quran we have no earthly idea what the background is. And in fact, most Islamic interpretation of the background of the Quran comes from the Hadith, which are collections of the actions, statements of Muhammad and his companions that were put together starting about 100 years after his death and are put together finally 200, 250 years after his death. Those collections become the lens through which the Quran is interpreted for the vast majority of Muslims. There's a small sect called Quran-only Muslims that would reject the necessity of reading the Hadith, but they're very, very, very small. Sunni orthodoxy is based upon using the Hadith as the lens.
James White is our guest. We're talking about the teachings of the Quran. It's Monday, April the 29th. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We'll be right back.
I need to be making the case that postmodernity, rather than dying and going away, has actually become the default setting for the way people think in many of the churches today.
Chris Roseborough, on his presentation, Postmodernism in the Church, at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 14th and 15th in Collinsville, Illinois.
As a result of it, it constitutes a significant threat against biblical, historic, orthodox Christianity, because its epistemology is extremely irrational, subjective-based, and in fact, it's even a form of enthusiasm, God-withinism, that at the end of the day has as its project the eroding away and deconstructing of what historic Christianity teaches and confesses.
You can find out more about the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 14th and 15th in Collinsville, Illinois, at issuesetc.org.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Does your church need a backup organist? The Virtual Organist service from Church Music Solutions is the next best thing to an on-site organist. Send us your musical choices, including liturgy and hymns. We'll assemble your service and send it to an iPad that controls your church's organ on Sunday. The result is genuine organ leadership on your instrument with your selections when you need it. See our videos on YouTube or visit our website at churchmusicsolutions.com.
Did you know that we send out an email each week that details upcoming show topics? It's available for you to include in your weekly church bulletin. Just click the logo for the Issues Etc. Journal and Weekly Bulletin insert at issuesetc.org and sign up to receive the Church Bulletin blurb. It's an easy way to invite your fellow parishioners to listen to Issues Etc. Issuesetc.org, look for the Issues Etc. Journal logo, and register to receive a weekly bulletin paragraph from Issues Etc.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We're talking about the teachings of the Quran. James White is our guest. He's director of Alpha and Omega Ministries based in Phoenix, Arizona, and he's authored several books. His latest, What Every Christian Needs to Know About the Quran. You can find out more about this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. So at the very outset, we're looking at a book that is going to be difficult to navigate. How would you describe, I'm searching for a word here, I don't want to sound pretentious, but how would you describe the genre of literature that we're looking at? I mean, the New Testament is epistolary and it's narrative for the most part. The Old Testament has both of those things, and it also has some poetry and things like that. What's the Quran in terms of the kind of literature we're looking at?
Most of the time, first-hand divine revelation. I mean, it's God speaking. There are certain stories that are told, which are rather intriguing. And it's very clear that the author of the Quran had much more familiarity with the Old Testament narrative than with the New. I don't see almost any familiarity with the New at all. And so you do have the retelling of certain Old Testament stories. They're cleaned up, because the perspective is that prophets can't really commit sin, and therefore the irony is you still have Nathan, for example, showing up with David, but there's no sin for David to repent of. So I'm not sure how Nathan got there, but it's just very clearly this kind of redacted story that is being retold. But most of the time, especially in the early portions of the Quran, it is very similar to what you'd find with the prophets. The foolishness of polytheism, the foolishness of worshiping anyone who cannot actually do anything good for you, that kind of material. And then it starts getting a little more mundane in the sense of dealing with certain issues, still in the first person of God doing this, but once Muhammad becomes the head of the Islamic State, the growing Islamic State, in Medina, then you have to start dealing with inheritance issues and legal issues and all the stuff that forms the essence of Sharia, which is so much in the news today as well. So it's pretty much just first-person divine, similar to what you'd have in the Trial of the False Gods in Isaiah 40-48.
So it's divine or alleged divine oracles.
Right, basically, yes.
What's the message? I mean, we can take the Bible, and as Christians, both Old and New Testament, we can say the message is Christ in his saving work, both Old and New Testament, the sum and substance of Old Testament prophecy fulfilled in the New Testament. Is there a message to the Quran?
The Islamic answer to that question, and I don't have any reason to really dispute it, the Islamic answer to that question is yes, and it's summarized in the one word, Tawheed. Tawheed is the oneness of Allah, and so the central affirmation of Islamic faith, and therefore the central message of the Quran, is that there is one God worthy of worship, and that is Allah, and that the essence of human existence is to be found in the proper worship of Allah, which, of course, involves, then, the observation of his law, which is the Sharia. So you find human fulfillment in the keeping of God's law. And that's the essence of that. I mean, then you'll have portions of the Quran. Well, for example, that address the Jews. There are portions of the Quran that address Christians. And Christians are told, for example, not to commit excess in their religion, that Jesus was a mere prophet, and that there are punishments for the sin of shirk, which is violating Tawheed, that is associating anyone or anything with Allah. And so we're directly addressed. Say not three. It is better for you. Hellfire is promised for those who say three. Well, three what? Well, every single time that the Quran uses that word three, it's immediately followed within the next sentence by saying there's only one God, Allah. And so clearly for the author of the Quran, we are talking about tritheism. We are promoting the concept of three gods. And so there are sections where you have correctives, but primarily of the Ahl al-Kitab, the people of the book, the Jews and the Christians. Sometimes you can't even tell whether it's Jews or Christians being addressed. Sometimes clearly you can. But the Ahl al-Kitab, the Ahl al-Injil, that's us, the people of the gospel, we're directly addressed a number of times in the text of the Quran. And so you will have in those divine oracles those kinds of things. But then you will find sections where it seems pretty obvious, okay, this was revealed after the Battle of Badr, this was revealed after the Battle of Uhud, and so you'll have some historical connections at those points with some of those events, and especially with the struggles that Muhammad had both when he was a minority prophet in Mecca and then with hypocrites and people trying to undercut his rulership in Medina and things like that. So it does help to have maybe a study edition of the Quran or something like that at least can give you some of that background information. But again, that's a guess on their part. That's going back to the Hadith and saying, well, the Hadith says that this was revealed at such and such a time, but that's a later interpretation. That's the very same situation we would encounter in making the patristic sources the lens through which we read everything in the New Testament, and that we would absolutely be dependent upon the patristic sources. That's the huge difference, because for some sections of the Quran, you just have no earthly idea what the background is. So without the Hadith, there's no way of knowing, but the problem is the Hadith are not a consistent body of materials. It's a huge body of material, and they're not consistent with themselves. So sometimes one person will say that this verse was narrated because of this, another person will say, no, it was because of this. So it's not actually consistent with itself.
Is the Quran internally consistent with itself? Is it coherent in terms of what it says and non-contradictory, or does the Quran itself appear to contradict itself?
Well, this raises the issue of what's called abrogation. The concept that is developed over time within Islam is that later revelations abrogate earlier revelations. And so you can actually have something dictated by God to Muhammad that becomes undone later. So the classic example of this is that in the earlier portion of the Quran, you have warnings against drunkenness. Do not come to prayers drunk, etc., etc. And later on in the Quran, it's like, don't touch alcohol at all. So you've had a clear development over time in the experience of Muhammad. And it's very interesting, if you read the Hadith, you find out why. He basically got fed up with drunks, in essence. And so now all of a sudden, you have Allah saying, no alcohol at all. And they would explain it on this concept of abrogation. From our perspective, obviously, it's development over time. One of the most troubling ones that I narrate in the book is the issue of adoption and the issue of Zainab bin Jash, one of Muhammad's wives, who was actually his first cousin, and was initially married to his adopted son and then was married to Muhammad. And it's very, very troubling because you end up with entire verses of what is an allegedly an eternal revelation, all meant to solve a problem which doesn't exist. And that is, Muhammad did something that was directly against the traditions of the Arabs at the time, and that is, he married the divorced wife of his adopted son. And all of a sudden, you end up with sections of the Quran that are commanding him to do this and, in essence, destroying adoption for Islamic countries from that point on, just simply so that Muhammad can be married to Zainab bin Jash. Again, the idea of trying to make this some type of eternal revelation that is uncreated, is as uncreated as Allah, really stretches the meaning of language at that particular point and is very, very troubling.
In terms of textual transmission, from what we can tell, is the Quran as Islam has it today the only version that has ever existed? Have parts been lost or destroyed? Are there major variations in its history?
Well, this is where we really need to dig in, and I've already been criticized for the book. I had one reviewer say, this isn't what every Christian needs to know, it's what every apologist needs to know. Well, my response to that was, if you're about to meet with a Muslim and they just read a book, what every Muslim needs to know about the Bible, wouldn't you want it to be done accurately and to some level of depth so that you could have a meaningful conversation? And that's been my experience here. The vast majority of Muslims that you will speak to believe that the Arabic Quran that they possess today is, in essence, identical to what was given to Muhammad. But there are clear evidences, and I spent an entire chapter on this particular issue. There is clear evidence that the Quran, like any ancient written document, has a history behind it. And even though the Quran is much shorter than the New Testament, claims a singular author, unlike the New Testament, which exhibits multivocality, multiple authors, multiple places, different times of writing, etc., etc., and existed in written form for a much shorter period of time before the printing press arrives, still it has a textual history. And what's most important is the early tafsir literature. Tafsir means commentary. The early tafsir literature was very open about this, was very open about the fact that you had multiple streams of tradition and readings in the Quran, primarily that which is found in Uthman, which is the modern-day Quran. The third caliph did a editing job, shall we say, a redaction would be the terminology we would normally use, around 650 A.D., about 20 years after Muhammad's death. And but then there are others that rejected that. Specifically, Abdullah ibn Mas'ud was one of the four men that Muhammad himself pointed to, according to the Hadith, to learn the Quran from. And ibn Mas'ud had different readings than Uthman did. And Ubay ibn Ka'b had different numbers of surahs than are found, the 114 that are found in the Quran today. And so there is evidence. The problem is, there is no such thing as accordance or Bible works or logos for Quran. It doesn't exist yet. There is an ongoing thing where they're going to try to create something like that, but it doesn't exist yet. Well, let's pick up with that if we can.
And we will on the other side of the break. James White is our guest, director of Alpha and Omega Ministries, author of the book, What Every Christian Needs to Know About the Quran. We're talking about the teachings of the Quran on this Monday afternoon, April the 29th. You can listen to Issues Etc. live and on demand with the new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. You can get these apps at our website, issuesetc.org. Give us a call, send us an email, or follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Issues Etc. in the palm of your hand. The new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. Download today at issuesetc.org.
There's an app for that.
We, the saints at St. Athanasius Lutheran Church, wish all lovers of the unshackled art of music unceasing grace from God our Father and our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. Since the beginning, the Church has spoken by her sacred hymns. Now is your chance to contribute to the great voice of the communion of saints throughout history with the St. Ambrose Hymn Writing Contest. Render your contribution to this great corpus of song. For more information, visit clamavi.com. That's C-L-A-M-A-V-I.com.
South Africa.
China,
Germany,
Trinidad and Tobago.
Did you know that people listen to Issues Etc. around the world? India,
Sweden,
Egypt, France,
Turkey,
Japan,
Australia,
Canada,
United Kingdom,
Hong Kong,
Austria,
Finland,
Malaysia,
Singapore,
Bulgaria,
Korea,
Brazil.
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Help us proclaim Christ to the world.
The Philippines,
Mexico,
Spain,
New Zealand,
Kuwait.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
As the reality of Obamacare sinks in, Americans are experiencing firsthand some of its negative effects. This is in addition to paying for abortion on demand and forcing companies to provide drugs that cause abortion. Large companies can't afford required health insurance for employees who work over 30 hours. This is the Obama administration's redefinition of full-time. Regal Entertainment Group, the nation's largest chain of movie theaters, has cut the hours of thousands of employees to under 30. Companies like Applebee's and Olive Garden are doing the same, as are colleges. It's generated a wave of full-time managers resigning because their hours have been cut substantially. It looks like Obamacare is single-handedly going to be responsible for massive unemployment.
Check out Life Issues on Facebook and stay more informed than you've ever been.
We're We're talking about the teachings of the Quran, the Muslim holy book. James White of Alpha and Omega Ministries is our guest, and we're taking your questions and your comments, giving away a couple copies of James' latest book called What Every Christian Needs to Know About the Quran. Our call-in number on this Monday afternoon, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. Our in-studio email address, talkback@issuesetc.org. Our Twitter address, @issuesetc. Or you can leave a question or a comment for James on the issue of the Quran at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. Facebook.com/issuesetc for the next half hour. James, pick up where you left off. You were talking about some serious problems with what we would call the transmission of the text when it comes to the Quran.
Well, you know, at this point in time, you and I can fire up our computers, we can fire up our iPads, and by the way, you guys have an app. That's pretty impressive. I don't have an app, so I'm feeling really out of sorts here now. But anyway, does Jeff's face come up when you bring it? Anyways, I shouldn't ask that question.
No.
Okay. All right. But anyway, we can fire these things up, and now we have the Nesyalan text or the all sorts of textual data right there. Nothing like that exists for the Quran. There is a project that's undergoing called the Corpus Chronicum Project. But there are a lot of Muslims that don't really think that's necessary. There's not a lot of cooperation, shall we say, except from Muslim scholars in more secular societies, in essence. And so the average Muslim really does see those footnotes in our Bibles as an evidence that their book is preserved and ours isn't. But they don't recognize that their own sources indicate that there was a redaction over time. And they don't care. In fact, I did a debate with Adnan Rashid in London last year. And as I pointed this out, he got up and said, well, if we can get back to Uthman, that's good enough for me. And in fact, it's very parallel to the arguments of King James onlyists. It's fascinating to see the parallel that exists there. And I direct you to the videos, but they haven't posted them yet, but hopefully they will soon, to see for yourself how many of the arguments that were used by my Islamic opponent were in fact parallel to what is found in, well, we have this tradition, God's preserved it, et cetera, even though it's just one reading amongst many. So it's it really is an important area. There's much more work that needs to be done in it, and it's pretty slow going right now. It's very difficult to get hold of the kind of materials that need to do, the kind of study that needs to be done.
You mentioned before, say not three, the kind of that refrain of the Quran, it, allegedly answering the Christian teaching of the Trinity. But I take it that if they're thinking tritheism, that the author of the Quran does not understand Orthodox Christianity.
No, I've read articles by Islamic apologists seeking to substantiate the idea that the Quran does accurately understand the doctrine of the Trinity. I've debated the subject. I debated Bassam Zawadi in London on this subject, and the irony was we ended up in that debate getting down to the point where I was defending the idea that we actually can know what the Quran is saying in one particular chapter, and my Muslim opponent was saying, no, we really can't. So the people in the audience found that to be fascinating, because if you just allow the Quran to speak for itself, it is rather painfully clear that the author of the Quran... The summary statement really is Surah 5, 116, where Allah says to Jesus at the Last Judgment, did you say to the people, worship me and my mother as gods in derogation of Allah? That's the only place where the three are ever mentioned, Allah, Mary, and Jesus. And it makes perfect sense when you think about Muhammad. He's a young man. He goes on caravan up into Syria. He probably stuck his head into some small Christian churches in Syria. What would he see? He would see artwork and statuary of God as creator. He would see the crucifix. He would see Mary holding a child. He'd probably see a dove, too, but that's not exactly going to suggest to him deity in any way. And so if you see a father figure, you have the son in the arms and the woman, well, there you go. There you have the idea. And when that's reflected directly in the text of the Quran, and I've never had any of my Muslim opponents really be able to explain, well, what is Surah 5, 116 saying then? What group was this addressed to? I mean, you had a group called the Coleridians that are mentioned briefly in church history as people who had worshipped Mary. But there's no evidence that they existed in Muhammad's day or had gotten to Mecca. And really, why in the world would the Quran be addressing a group that didn't even exist anymore if it's an eternal revelation? Didn't God know they weren't going to exist anymore by the time the Quran came around? So it's a real problem for the Muslim to deal with the reality that the Quran does not accurately represent the doctrine of the Trinity, does not really seem to understand what we believe by sonship or anything like that. And that's one of the primary arguments that I make in the book as well, because even if you disagree with the doctrine of the Trinity, you have to admit this. In 632 A.D., God knew what it was. God knew what the doctrine of the Trinity was. If he wanted to refute it, he could do so clearly and accurately, but he didn't. So doesn't that mean that the author of the Quran is not, in fact, God? Instead, it much more logically reflects the thinking and thought process of a man who lived in that time period and in that place.
What about, we would say, the doctrine of the incarnation or the divinity of the Son? Does the Quran reflect, even though it rejects it, does it reflect an accurate understanding of the Christian view of Christ's divinity, in particular of his divinity and humanity?
No. The author of the Quran does not understand what we mean by incarnation, does not understand the Son eternally existed as the Son. Instead, the Quran sees the filial relationship as a sexual relationship, that is, Allah taking a wife. In fact, I asked my Arabic tutor about a particular phrase in the Quran where the Quran says, how could God have a son if he does not have a sahiya of a, and he sort of smiled and said, well, in modern Arabic, that's sort of the woman on the side. Sometimes it's translated spouse or mate or wife or something along those lines. And so the polemic is very much against the concept of a male deity, female deity, offspring concept. There just isn't any understanding anywhere in the Quran of eternal sonship or incarnation or the voluntariness of this or anything of those kinds at all. It just isn't there. And when you read the hadith and read Muhammad's few interactions with Christians, there's allegedly an incident where he meets with a deputation from Najran, and then you read the results of that in the Quran, because allegedly some portions of the Quran came about as result of this. Clearly, the author does not have any understanding, an accurate understanding, of what it is Christians believe. And obviously, this is something that has then been the matrix in which Islamic apologetics has had to work since the end of the Islamic expansion. As you know, Islam expands from 632 to 732, and then sort of the borders sort of hardened at that point, and eventually Islamic scholarship has to start dealing with the reality of what our texts actually say. And that's when you start seeing the accusation that we have changed our texts, that our texts are the ones that are corrupted, because the reality is, if the Quran is dealing with the books we have today, then the author of the Quran really didn't know them and misrepresented them. So the only way around that is to say, well, the reality is you've changed your books. So your scriptures have been corrupted. And that's how the Muslim understands it.
One more question in that vein, then we'll go to some of our listeners' questions. Who is the Jesus of the Quran? He's in there. Who is he?
He is an argument. There is a liberal scholar, Muslim scholar at Cambridge, who has rightly said, and I quoted it in the book, the Jesus of the Quran is not a person, he's an argument. Only once in the Quran does Jesus speak from an identifiable location, and that is from his cradle, a story actually derived from the Arabic infancy gospel written about 150 years before the Quran, and the author of the Quran does not show any recognition of the fact that this is a later fable. And so Jesus actually speaks from his cradle. But other than that, Jesus is a disembodied voice. He does not speak in history. He does not speak in geography. He just sort of floats around and says things about monotheism, the need to worship one true God, and prophethood. And that's pretty much it. And that's why you can't love that Jesus, because he's not a person. It's just a voice, just words spoken that don't really have any context. And so while Muslims will often say, well, we're the second largest religion in the world that teaches people to love Jesus, I don't know how you could love the Islamic Jesus, because he is just, there's no personhood there to admire or to interact with or to learn anything from. He's just an argument.
A question from Andrew with about a minute before we take our next break. He says, why do Muslims say that the only true Quran is the one written in Arabic?
Well, Arabic, as you've probably noted, how many terms I've had to use. I've had to explain what tawhid, shirk, tafsir. You cannot understand Islam, unfortunately. You can't dialogue intelligently with a Muslim without learning a certain amount of Arabic vocabulary. That's why there's a glossary in the book. Because these are the very words of Allah, then they cannot be translated into another language. Evidently, Allah does speak Arabic. And since these have eternally existed with Allah, then the only true form that they have is in the language in which they were given, which is in Arabic. Any translation is going to be lesser than that, and so you don't really have the Quran at that point. That's why the supremacy of Arabic and hence the Arabic Quran is so important to Muslims.
James White is our guest when we come back. 10 more minutes with him on this Monday afternoon, the 29th of April. We're talking about the teachings of the Quran. He's director of Alpha and Omega Ministries based in Phoenix, Arizona. And he's authored several books, including his latest, What Every Christian Needs to Know About the Quran. We're giving that book away to the listener with the best question or comments. And we're coming to you live, 1-877-623-MYIE. Talk back at issuesetc.org or our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc.
Here's a special offer for Issues Etc. listeners. For any size gift during the Easter season, we'll send you a recording of an Ascension and Pentecost sermon preached by Pastor Todd Wilkin. You can make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also contribute by check. Make your check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois 62234. Issues Etc. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. And for any size gift between Easter Sunday and Pentecost Sunday, May 19th, we'll send you a CD of one of Todd's Ascension and Pentecost sermons. Now, when you make your gift, please indicate whether you want a downloadable version or a CD of these sermons. Thanks for listening, and thanks for thinking of us during the Easter season.
Providing artillery support for the church militant on the front lines, you're listening to Issues Etc.
What happens when you take solid doctrine and solid curriculum and combine them with ancient scholars and modern technology? You get Wittenberg Academy, the very first completely online classical Lutheran high school. We are unabashedly Lutheran and offer families a rigorous standard of academic excellence. Students can pick and choose classes, or they can utilize our entire curriculum for their high school education. Visit our website, wittenbergacademy.org, to find out more.
Have you wondered what classical Lutheran education is all about? Are you a Lutheran homeschooler? Would you like to learn more about teaching students the essentials of biblical interpretation, law and gospel, or worldviews from a Lutheran perspective? Come join the Consortium for Classical and Lutheran Education July 16th through the 18th at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. For more information, visit ccle.org. That's ccle.org. Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We're talking about the teachings of the Quran. James White is our guest. See what Kathy in St. Charles, Missouri has to say. Hi, Kathy.
Yeah, well, your guest was saying that that Allah apparently speaks Aramaic. I guess, what did he speak before the language existed in eternity, or do they even look at it that way? And then also, you know, where did he exist before, and the religion itself, religion the Muslims have before the Quran was written?
It's a good question, Kathy. Thank you very much. Thanks for listening in St. Charles. James?
Well, I'm not trying to say that from their perspective Allah is limited only to the Arabic language. The point is that the actual words in Arabic, not Aramaic, but Arabic, that are found in the Quran are considered in Orthodox Sunni circles as being as eternal as Allah. They are uncreated. They did not come into existence, which obviously does beg the question, well, but if they're in a language that came into existence, how does that work? You'd have to ask the Muslim how that works. But it was one of the major early controversies within Sunni Islam as to whether you could identify the Quran as something that was created or not created. And from the, you got to remember, from the Islamic perspective, Jesus was a Muslim. Abraham was the founder of Islam. He established the Kaaba in Mecca as a place of pure monotheistic worship. And so from their perspective, they are the first religion. Everyone's born as a Muslim. Everyone's born on what's called fitra, which is they understand that Allah exists, and then their parents pervert them into Jews or Christians or anything else. So from their perspective, Islam is first, and we are variations from that.
Mark has this question, and it inevitably comes up with the subject of Islam or the Quran. He says, I've heard that there are two views on jihad. One is literal war, the other one is not. What is jihad according to the Quran?
Well, the vast majority of jihad that is mentioned in the Quran is in the context of a physical fighting in defense of the Islamic community. The doctrine of jihad can be identified as including that spiritual element, obviously, within it. But the problem is that the sources that we use to interpret the Quran and to define jihad are not consistent with themselves, and therefore you can have people who emphasize one kind of source over against another, and you get a jihad that's primarily an issue of internal struggle, desiring to be pleasing to God, helping others, giving alms, etc., etc. And then you have people and scholars who emphasize other elements of the Hadith literature, and it's very easy to end up with the radical perspective of you need to be engaged in jihad now, even though there's not a caliph that has pronounced jihad, Islam is under attack, this is the only way that you can know you're going to have peace with God, etc., etc. And we've seen the results of what happens when that takes place.
Becky listens in Japan. Becky asks, and you mentioned this briefly before, do all Muslims understand that the earlier verses of the Quran are abrogated by later verses?
It's always scary to use the word all of anybody. That's like saying, do all Christians believe X, Y, or Z? You'll obviously find certain Muslims who will have a significantly modified doctrine of abrogation over against others. But the concept has to be found everywhere, because there are those texts where you just clearly have a change over time, and how you deal with that depends, again, on your viewpoint on how abrogation is to be applied.
Let's see. Brian in Albuquerque, New Mexico asks, how dependent are Muslims upon their commentaries, since most laymen among Muslims memorize the Quran simply as rote repetition? It seems they always rely on an exclusive imam, a teacher, or an interpreter.
Yeah, they do. Very rarely do Muslims do a lot of direct interaction with the text themselves. They have an imam, they have a perspective, they have a group of jurisprudence that they follow after. And as I said, the hadith, the sunnah of the prophet, the life of the prophet, really does become the lens through which the text of the Quran itself is interpreted. And it's very difficult to encourage Muslims to recognize that fact and to recognize the need of the examination of that external source so that you can actually go back to what the Quran itself is saying. Obviously, that happens with a lot of Christians, too. That's a major issue that we discuss. But it's even more so the case in this situation.
Are there prophecies, predictions made in the Quran?
That's a fascinating area. It gets us into eschatology, and eschatology gives me hives even when talking about Christian eschatology, to be perfectly honest with you. I was fascinated to discover that there are more books being cranked out in the Islamic world on eschatology and end-time speculation than we produce. Had no earthly idea, but you look at what's going on in Iran, you sort of get that idea. So clearly there's plenty of material in the Quran that no one really knows what it's about, and that's a great thing to use for prophecy. There's almost nothing in the Quran as far as a specific, I mean, other than saying Muhammad's going to be found in the Bible and stuff like that, there's almost nothing that says, well, this is going to happen at this time in this place and that type of thing. There really isn't much of that. Most of the material that is most popularly looked at as being prophetic is found in the Hadith. And even then, it's a fairly small portion of that, and yet it is speculated upon widely by Muslims.
Is it true that the Quran explicitly denies the events of the cross as the New Testament depict them?
Yes. I don't know that the author really understands what the nature of the cross was, but there is one ayah, 40 Arabic words, Surah 4, 157, which states that the Jews boasted that they had killed the Messiah, the son of Mary, but they did not kill him near, they crucify him, but so it was made to appear to them. Shubih Halahim is the Arabic, and that's understood by the majority of Muslims in the world as being someone else was made to look like Jesus. And so they believe in the substitution theory that most people believe Judas was actually put upon the cross and crucified and made to look like Jesus while Jesus was taken up to heaven. I've had Muslims say it was Simon the Cyrene, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of Western Muslims don't want to go that far. They'll say Allahu Alam, God knows, rather than affirming that there was an actual substitute put on the cross. Because if that's the case, then in essence, Allah started the Christian religion by mistake, by deceiving people too well, by making someone look like it was Jesus, and now you've got this entire religion that produces all these acts of shirk, et cetera, et cetera. So, but if you're talking to a Muslim who comes from another country, they will almost always hold the substitution idea that someone else was crucified in Jesus' place.
In your experience, how well-versed is the average Western Muslim in the particulars of the Quran? You said at the beginning of our conversation that hands would probably not be raised very high if asked in an average mosque how many of you have read it.
Actually have read the Bible, not the Quran.
Oh, okay.
You're actually obviously living as a minority in a Western country is going to mean that your Westernized Muslim is probably going to be much more familiar with the text of the Quran, and because of the freedom that they have here, might take somewhat of a different perspective than what you would have in an Islamic country where you have very strict controls over what can and cannot be believed and not as much freedom of religion. So, yeah, I think your Westernized Muslim, because they're so often called upon to defend their faith or to explain their faith, is going to have a greater firsthand knowledge of it than many who live in lands where nominalism is the rule.
Will they be, in essence, on average, kind of liberalized Muslims? In other words, playing fast and loose with the text in front of them?
Well, it's possible. I've encountered a wide variety of perspectives. I was talking with a Muslim man in Leicester Square in London while we were doing street preaching, and it was very odd to run into postmodern Islamic thought. that just doesn't fit real well. You know, someone who clearly is wanting to fit in with the culture and think like the culture and yet still hold on to some type of element of Islam, and the result is not overly recognizable as being actual Islam, because Islam and postmodernism really don't fit too well together. But you will find a broader variety of perspectives amongst Westernized Muslims. And the Muslims are concerned about that. It's fascinating to listen to them speaking about their concern about losing their young generation, because they're listening to Western music and they're adopting Western styles and eventually overthrowing the traditions that are a part of Islam. And so while that kind of Islam would never survive in an Islamic country, that is one of their concerns, is that they're losing those younger generations to a more liberal form or to really an abandonment of Islam as a whole.
James White is director of Alpha and Omega Ministries, based in Phoenix, Arizona. He's authored several books, including his latest, What Every Christian Needs to Know About the Quran. You'll find a link to this book under the Listen On Demand page at issuesetc.org. James, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Kathy in St. Charles, Missouri, and Brian in Albuquerque, New Mexico, if you would send us your mailing address, talkback@issuesetc.org, talkback@issuesetc.org. We will send you the book, What Every Christian Needs to Know About the Quran. In hour two of Issues Etc. this Monday afternoon, we're going to spend the entire hour responding to something that the president only took about 12 minutes to say on Friday. He was speaking at Planned Parenthood's national conference. He was very warmly received. There was a lot of affection between the president and his audience there. This is the president's crowd. And he, for the most part, spoke quite frankly about Planned Parenthood. I noticed something, however. When he made this 12-minute speech to Planned Parenthood, he never mentioned the word abortion. Now, we're going to respond to most of what the president had to say in hour two of Issues, etc. Scott Klusendorf will be our guest, president of Life Training Institute. Speaking of Islam, Islam will be one of the topics at the Issues, etc. Making the Case conference. We're going to have one of our regular guests, Dr. Alvin Schmidt, making the case against Islam at our Issues, etc. Making the Case conference. It's June the 14th and 15th right here in Collinsville, Illinois. All of our listeners are invited to attend. You can meet Rod Rosenblatt, Alvin Schmidt. You can meet Chris Roseborough, Will Wheaton, and others. It's a two-day conference. It's $100 a piece. Three meals are included, and you can register online, issuesetc.org, or call Craig right here in the studio, 618-223-8385. Ask for Craig, and he'll help you register for the Issues, Etc. Making the Case conference, June the 14th and 15th, right here in Collinsville, Illinois. Hour two is next.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
The grace of God, the church's music, the Lord's Supper, every service, every Sunday, and Wednesdays too, preaching Christ crucified and risen. There is hope in St. Louis, Hope Lutheran Church, that is, 5218 Neosho Street, St. Louis, Missouri, or find us on the web at hopelutheranstl.org.
You can meet Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Alvin Schmidt Saturday morning, May the 4th at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. Dr. Schmidt will be signing his new book, The American Muhammad, from 10 to 11 Saturday morning at Lober Hall on the campus of Concordia Seminary. You'll get 30% off the book price, and Concordia Publishing House will provide free donuts and coffee. A book signing for The American Muhammad from 10 to 11 Saturday morning, May the 4th at Concordia Seminary, St. Louis.